You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Last week, the reports of Salman Taseer's assassination made headlines around the world. Salman Taseer was the governor of the Punjab province in Pakistan. It's the largest province of that country. He had been killed by one of his own security guards, and the assassination came amidst growing political disintegration in Pakistan. The government's ruling coalition has been fragmenting, and the Islamist opposition growing stronger. To help make sense of the situation in Pakistan, we're joined on the phone from Berkeley, California, by Con Hallinan. He's an analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus. Good morning, and welcome again to Red Eye, Con.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Why was Salman Taseer targeted for assassination?
Well, the specific reason was that he was a vocal opponent of the blasphemy laws, which go back to the military dictatorship in the 1980s, and that was a specific reason why he was shot. I think one of the problems here, and I think you have to keep things sort of in balance in Pakistan. On one hand, Pakistan seems to be kind of disintegrating, and there, if you read most of the American press, what you read is that there's this rising tide of Islamic extremism. Actually, there's not a huge amount of evidence for that. The Islamists have never particularly done well in Pakistan. They've never gotten more than 30% of the vote. And they're a small section of the elected representatives. Now, that's not to say that the Islamic extremism isn't a powerful force in Pakistan. If it can assassinate people, it's certainly a powerful force. And there is an internal Taliban war going on with the Pakistani state. But I do think that people kind of overstate that a little bit. I mean, there's a tendency for the American media to start shouting, "The turbans are coming, the turbans are coming." And actually, the secular government in Pakistan is actually quite strong. The weaknesses in Pakistan have to do with a lot of very structural issues. You have enormous a gap between rich and poor. You have in the countryside a largely feudal regime that runs the place. You have a ruling class which basically doesn't pay taxes. You have a declining infrastructure, etc. But I think it's also, let me just end on this, I think it's also interesting to note that while Pakistan is always contrasted with India, the health figures for Pakistan and for things like malnutrition, etc., Pakistan does better than India does. So I think that I'm certainly worried about the growth of Islamic extremism in Pakistan, but I do think that people need to step back a little bit and kind of take a deep breath and say, you know, part of this is what is the way that it's being portrayed in the American media. It's not necessarily a reflection of exactly the way it is on the ground.
I can understand how the media and political forces here in North America have an interest in playing up the role of Islamic extremism, because that fits into the rationale for the war on terror. I'm wondering, as Salman Taseer, who was assassinated, was the leading figure in one of the leading figures, certainly in the political party that rules, has until it lost its majority in Parliament just shortly ago. How sincere, in fact, they are in being committed themselves to secularism, or whether it's something that's used off and on for opportune reasons.
Well, I do think opportunism certainly comes into it, and commitment. You know, that's really kind of hard to say. Political parties tend to be committed to what gets them elected. And I think that if the ruling party, of any of the strong parties in Pakistan, come to the conclusion that it's in their interests to, for instance, be firm supporters of the blasphemy laws or to push for Sharia law and things like that. They'll do it. I mean, in that sense, I don't think Pakistani politicians are any different than American politicians, and they will certainly support what gets them elected. At the same time, I do think that it is important for people to realize that we've been talking about, and certainly American media has been talking about, the growth of Islamic extremism for years and years and years in Pakistan, certainly since the end of the 1990s, since about 2000, 2001, etc. And in that time, there actually has not been a growth in the Islamic parties in Pakistan. They have not garnered a larger base. They have not done better in elections, etc. I don't want to make too light of this, but I think there are other issues going on in Pakistan that are not being reported, and that those have more to do with the instability. I would also be careful of talking about the instability as that the country is disintegrating. I don't think the country is disintegrating. I do think that there are major problems, and I think unless Pakistan begins to seriously address the disparity of wealth and access to land and things like that, then I think they're headed in the long run for some very, very serious problems.
You mentioned factors of instability. Let's look at one of those, the drone war that the United States is waging in Pakistan's northwest region. What is that contributing?
Well, right now the figures show that about 85% of Pakistanis consider the Americans a greater threat than terrorism. And I think you've got tremendous anger against these drones. First of all, we don't know who the drones are killing, and the Pakistanis do. In other words, if you ask, say, the Central Intelligence Agency, which is the drones that are being used in North Waziristan, and which the U.S. is trying to extend to other areas, including Baluchistan, these are run by the Central Intelligence Agency. The U.S. military runs the drones that are used in Afghanistan itself, but the CIA runs the ones that are used in Pakistan. And if you ask them what's the criteria for targeting, you really can't get an answer. I mean, what they say is, well, you know, we hit this compound and we killed 11 militants. Well, what's a militant? Is it someone whose house somebody is in? Sometimes those people have no, you know, choice as to whether or not they put up a member of the Taliban. Taliban are armed, they're not. How are these decisions made? We have no idea. The American people have no idea whatsoever. So for the Pakistanis, they're arguing that only about 6% of the people that are killed by these drone attacks are actual militants, etc., and that most of them are civilians. So this causes a great deal of anger. The other point, which Americans are missing on this one, the Obama administration argues that there has to be a diplomatic resolution to the war in Afghanistan. And everyone says this. And Gates says this, and Obama says this, and Petraeus says this, and everything like that. But what we're doing with these drones is that we're essentially assassinating the people that you're going to eventually have to sit down and talk with. And what's happening is that by killing the, quote, leaders of the Taliban, it hasn't had any effect on the Taliban. A recent survey by NATO said that there are just as many members of the Taliban, active members of the Taliban, today as there were a year ago before the major surge of troops. So it doesn't have any effect on the Taliban. But what it has done is that it's replaced by killing a lot of the senior leadership through the drone attacks and also through night raids in Afghanistan. What you're doing is that you're getting a kind of another generation of Taliban leaders. These tend to be much younger, they tend to be much more local, and they tend to be much more radical. So we're creating a situation where it's going to be, if we continue to do this, well, we're going to have to negotiate some sort of agreement, valley by valley, with people who are a lot less sophisticated and many times much more radical. So we're sort of, the drones are not only causing a lot of unrest because of the civilian casualties, but most Pakistanis recognize that what the drones are doing is that they're killing the people that the U.S. and NATO eventually is going to have to talk to, and it's like killing the peace. It doesn't make any sense. So on a lot of levels, there is enormous opposition to the drone war.
Now, many people listening would say, okay, I see the connection between the drone war and the resolution of the conflict both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. But you go further than that, and you argue that the events in Kashmir are also very much connected to the resolution of the conflict. How so?
Well, the whole area is like the old spiritual, you know, knee bones connected to thigh bones connected to the hip bone. Whenever I get a sort of visual image of the region, I think in terms of Rubik's cubes, you know, with all the little colored things and all interconnected and spread all over the place. Let's just start, say, for instance, with Afghanistan. Okay, there's a war going on in Afghanistan, and people need to realize that there's a reason why Afghanistan has been called the graveyard of empires. It's because empires have always tried to use Afghanistan because it is the crossroads to Asia. You go south into the Indian subcontinent. You go east into China. You go north into the Caspian. You go west into Iran and the Middle East. And so, in that sense, Afghanistan has always been this enormously important strategic area. Now, what you've got in this case, and why I think Kashmir is very important here, people need to realize that the single most dangerous area right now in the world is Kashmir. This is a place which has essentially been at war for 63 years. It has sparked three wars between India and Pakistan. In the 1999 Kargil incident, the Pakistanis actually took their nuclear warheads out of storage and started putting them on missiles. And the Clinton administration sort of blew the whistle and they backed off of it. But it came that close to something happening. And there have been something like 50,000 to 80,000 deaths in these wars. Lots have disappeared, lots of people imprisoned, etc. Kashmir is the flashpoint for India and Pakistan. And the Pakistanis' point of view is that India is much stronger than they are, a much bigger army, etc. It is occupying Kashmir. And also, India has deployed paramilitaries in Afghanistan, is one of the largest aid suppliers to the Afghan government, and is building up influence. So from the Pakistanis' point of view, they're surrounded on all sides, basically by the Indians on one border and by the Indians on another border. They see this as a kind of existential sort of thing. And Kashmir then becomes the place where the greatest tensions exist, and it also then thereby washes into Afghanistan, so that you've got this competition between India and Pakistan and Afghanistan, with the Pakistanis favoring certain particular groups of militants like the Haqqani group and the Taliban, the Shura, Khetta Shura of the Taliban. It's based in Baluchistan. You've got the Indians, on the other hand, building up aid and road systems and paramilitaries, etc., in southern Afghanistan. I mean, you know, this is all interconnected here. And essentially, what you have to do is that you have, when we talk about a resolution of this thing, you've really got to take into account the interests of all of the actors. And one of the reasons I was very disappointed about President Obama's recent visit to India was that while he was running for president back in 2008, he talked about the importance of settling Kashmir. He knew it would be difficult, but that would be important to settle. He never mentioned Kashmir when he went to India, because the Indians don't want him to mention Kashmir. And the Indians don't want him to mention Kashmir because they don't want to talk about Kashmir. They want to leave the situation as it is. The U.S. doesn't want to make the Indians unhappy because they see the Indians as a crucial kind of section of the Rubik's Cube in their alliance against a growing China. So India, South Korea, Japan, this is this kind of alliance system that that the U.S. is setting up to contain China. So you see, everything's interconnected here. And that's why, you know, you look at it, you say, boy, it's confusing. It is confusing. And there's a huge number of cross-currents and competing influences that are at work here. It's not that it isn't solvable. It is solvable. This, you know, anybody can solve a Rubik's Cube if you take the time to do it. But I do think that what people have to do in the region is to recognize that there are real different interests here, and somehow an agreement has to make a compromise between all of those different interests there.
Well, thanks for outlining and delineating the complexity and the interconnections. Very helpful. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you very much, Mordecai. Anytime.
I've been speaking with Con Hallinan. He's an analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus, and you can check out his articles on Pakistan and other issues at the website fpif.org.